Welcome, beloved listeners, to our little wireless program. Later in the show, we're going to head off to Cuba with its fascinating collection of Castros. But first, I want to provide you with some very important background on the history of Cambodia from where we've just returned. You may have heard last week's program, my visit to the killing fields and my interview with opposition leader and head of the Cambodian National Rescue Party, which seems in urgent need of rescue itself. But from what Sam Rainsy said, the culture and thinking of the current ruling party, the CPP, and the leadership of Hun Sen were not that different to that of the Khmer Rouge leaders. Now, to discuss this and to get a stronger grasp of the road which led to the events of 40 years ago, when the Khmer Rouge emptied Phnom Penh of its residents and ushered in year zero, we've gathered together a panel of historians and journalists. In Sydney, I'm with my old mate, Dr. Milton Osborne, a former diplomat, historian, and now currently a visiting fellow at the Lowy Institute for International Policy, the author of many books on Cambodia, including the classic The Mekong. From our Canberra TARDIS, it's Emeritus Professor Carl Thayer from the University of New South Wales School of Humanities and Social Sciences at the Australian Defence Force Academy. And welcome back to you, Carl. And finally, we've tracked down the intrepid Sebastian Stringer, the former Australian editor of the Phnom Penh Post. We couldn't find him while we were there. He is, of course, the author of the highly regarded book Hun Sen's Cambodia, and he's on the blower from Sri Lanka. Gentlemen, I welcome you all. First of all, a question I'll put to each of you in turn. So to you first, Milton. Is Sam Rainsy correct about the endurance of former Khmer Rouge members in the current government?
Yes, he is correct. Although I would have to take issue with the suggestion that the current government is really to be compared with the Khmer Rouge government. There is much that I have criticised and continue to criticise about the present government. It's authoritarian. It has sanctioned brutality in the operation of its policies. But it is not in any sense genocidal in the way that the Khmer Rouge government was.
Carl, I know your view is that this is complex. It's not simple black and white, that nobody's hands are clean. Talk to that.
Well, the comparison I would make is to look at Nazi Germany and ask, can we make a distinction between the Gestapo and the SS and people who carried out genocide and the Wehrmacht, the army itself? And then if we go back to Cambodia, we can say, yeah, there was an inner party center that conducted purges. They were conducted provincially. But Hun Sen that we're talking about was a regimental commander who actually fled to Vietnam. He had fought and lost an eye in combat, and his style is quite, it's authoritarian. It may have borrowed a bit of Marxist-Leninism from Vietnam, but I agree with Milton that he has not promoted a policy of mass murder, although the CPP and some of his minions have, from about 1997 onwards, if not earlier, targeted the opposition and have seen to their demise.
Sebastian, Hun Sen was a former commander with the KR before defecting to the Vietnamese forces. And in April, he was heard to vow to prevent new indictments and said he'd be quite happy if Cambodia left the UN. What's your view on this?
Well, I think it shows the extreme sensitivity that these issues still have in Cambodian politics. The Khmer Rouge tribunals have been an incredibly complicated tangle of Cambodian government interests and international interests. And Hun Sen, since the beginning of these trials, has sought to control the narrative and ensure that whatever lessons are drawn from these trials can serve the political interests of the Cambodian People's Party. And I think they're incredibly paranoid. I don't think that there's any chance. I mean, as Carl said, Hun Sen was a person of relatively little direct responsibility in the Khmer Rouge. He was a member of the military. There's not really any chance that he would be put on trial, either politically or legally, but I think that shows they had quite a lot of fear that this could happen.
In your book, Sebastian, you quote Hun Sen telling his enemies, quote, "Even if you farted, I will still know you cannot hide from me." Apart from sounding Lyndon Johnsonian, what does it tell us about the bloke?
Well, I I think Hun Sen sees himself much in the tradition of past Cambodian leaders. Like Norodom Sihanouk, who ruled Cambodia in the 1960s, he sort of tried to establish himself as a larger-than-life figure who encompasses his country's destiny. And in some way is providentially chosen to sort of lead Cambodia into a new era of peace and stability. This is how he sees himself, I think. But it shows that he has a very large ego, which I think to a certain extent has been his recent undoing in terms of the opposition support that has kind of erupted in the last few years. And it shows that he's probably not going to change the way he does things, regardless of how many foreign leaders and foreign governments complain about it.
Sebastian, the war left Cambodia with one of the highest proportions of amputees in the world, one for every 290 people. And a Cambodian psychiatrist you met noticed, unsurprisingly, very high levels of depression, anxiety, psychosis amongst the population. He detected a cultural response to trauma, which he called broken courage.
Yes, that's right. I think it's quite hard. I'm not a psychiatrist, and I think it's quite hard for most people to really quantify the echo of trauma in throughout Cambodian society. And except to say that the impact of this stuff has been absolutely massive. My read on the Khmer Rouge experience is that it served to heighten and emphasize all of the most conservative, deferential aspects in Cambodian culture. So after the Khmer Rouge, people are left like shipwreck survivors clinging to whatever they can find. And the CPP and Hun Sen, after 1979, play on this very effectively. They depict themselves as the only bastion of sort of culture and normality in this sea of chaos. And, you know, they've been able to manipulate that popular trauma to great effect.
Milton, as I wandered around the country talking to people, many very prominent citizens who you would have think would have been absolutely relaxed having conversations were tense and anxious and nervous and looking over their shoulder. But the one thing I asked everyone was to explain to me, and this has haunted me ever since the Khmer Rouge marched into town, how could such a gentle people be involved in this immense atrocity? Now, you don't cop this gentle land, do you? You think
no,
this
I don't.
Is an historic misnomer?
One has to be very careful about historical psychoanalysis, but it's quite wrong to suggest that somehow or other Cambodia did not have deep within its historical experience a readiness to behave in an extremely brutal fashion, or for the people in charge to do so. If you look at Cambodian folk tales, they are often quite gruesome, with heroic princesses triumphing over their enemies and then eviscerating the bodies as they lie on the ground. The idea that Cambodia was somehow gentle and peaceful in a way that other countries were not is simply a historical nonsense.
And you also point out that Norodom Sihanouk's reign from the 50s to the 70s had its times of savagery.
There were some very dark elements to Sihanouk's reign. They had a brutal special police, secret police. There were disappearances. There were assassinations. There were brutalization of people, including Khieu Samphan, in public. All of which were known, but very little talked about, not least because Sihanouk is extraordinarily successful in having a cheer squad of foreign journalists promoting his reign.
Well, Carl, that's true. I remember how seductive he could be. What's your response to Sihanouk's reign?
Well, I think Milton has pretty well captured it. The amount of violence and what he's talking about is reprehensible, but it's relatively small scale to what came after. But that left a residue. But I'd go further that before Sihanouk was overthrown, the Cambodian military put down a rebellion in western Cambodia, in Samlaut Rebellion in Battambang Province, with great brutality. And peasants were treated very harshly. So if we're looking at the kind of origins of the Khmer Rouge, we can go way back into into history and find the, as Milton has pointed out, the ungentleness of Cambodian rural life. We can see then the victimhood of people being attacked or dispossessed by the military themselves. And then we can find the key leadership element, those members educated up to a point, prevented by Sihanouk from gaining access to the inner circles of power in that country, and therefore and being forced out or, Khieu Samphan, humiliated in public, fleeing the cities and sparking a rural rebellion.
Back to you in Sri Lanka, Sebastian. Would you try a brief piece of psychoanalysis of the Cambodian people?
Oh, look, it's an incredibly murky territory, as Milton said, to try and psychoanalyze history. I mean, I think it's true that the Khmer Rouge period represents a huge qualitative spike in violence and brutality, but those sorts of things had not been unknown before then. The Issaraks in the 1950s committed very similar atrocities to what would later be attributed to the Khmer Rouge, or committed by the Khmer Rouge. That similar dynamic has persisted more or less until the present.
Milton, staying with this period for a little longer, the tension between South and North Vietnam saw Sihanouk flirting with Ho Chi Minh, even though he wasn't a communist. But it sort of, his eccentricity gave Nixon pause, didn't it? It sort of fitted into Nixon's theory of the domino.
The period in the latter stages of the 1960s, before Sihanouk was overthrown, extremely interesting for historians of Cambodia, because Sihanouk had made a bet on the North Vietnamese winning the ultimate conclusion of the Vietnam War that was going on next door. But by 1967, he'd begun to wonder whether his bet was right, and he then engaged on a program of rapprochement with the United States, which saw the United States return to re-establish their diplomatic mission in Phnom Penh. The great feeling that I judge was present in the United States about what happened during that period was that they couldn't quite ever be sure, as you're suggesting, which way Sihanouk was going to jump. And then into that particular and very complex mix came the coup that overthrew Sihanouk in 1970, which I resolutely say to this day was not a CIA-inspired coup, although without any doubt American intelligence services knew that something was happening.
This is LNL on RN and all its strange high-tech platforms, and my guest Milton Osborne, Carl Thayer, Sebastian Stringer. Carl, you were, let's move on to 67, 68. You were a civilian volunteer working along the Vietnamese-Cambodian border. Describe the impact of a B-52 bombing.
Well, yeah, I was in the town of An Loc, but journeyed up to the border on occasion, and I was a volunteer teacher of English in the local high school. The province had some Khmer minorities, and they provided the guards for the compound in which I was living, so I taught them English at night. I volunteered to do that in return for my safety. If you have a bombing campaign across the border, it can be kept secret from the American public, but you can feel the tremors at your feet. But the major U.S. bombing that we're talking about, Operation Menu, began in 69, a year after I left Vietnam. But it's, you know, they make an instant swimming, Olympic-sized swimming pool out of the ground. But in other words, it... in that province, we'd had attacks preceding the Tet Offensive coming from communist sanctuaries, and that's the issue we really hadn't touched on, that the Vietnamese communists occupying portions of land inside the Cambodian border then made them targets of the U.S. and the South Vietnamese, and then it became a political issue in Cambodia itself.
It's an article of faith amongst my generation that those bombings helped create or certainly harden the resolve of the Khmer Rouge. Is that correct?
Well, we have very little evidence that when people are bombed, that makes them want to capitulate completely to the person that's doing the bombing, the Battle of Britain, that sort of spirit, the use of air power in the Korean War, etc. And I think that it's William Shawcross's book and a very memorable passage that I used to read to cadets and midshipmen at the Defense Academy. You don't know that you're being bombed with the whistles. It's the ground erupting. And as the Khmer Rouge were making their push across Cambodia to seize power, and they were subject subject to this bombing, and large numbers of civilians were killed. The ground was erupting, and it just hardened them that those who supported the bombing and called in foreigners were the enemy. And there was a blood brotherhood that formed of those who survived.
So Milton, I didn't mean to interrupt.
It hardened the core.
Milton, a previous guest on this program, a certain Henry Kissinger, has been heard to argue that his decision to bomb Cambodia to remove the Viet Cong was justified and, in fact, would probably be repeated today. How much less damaging than Obama's drone campaign in Pakistan? Well, that's Kissinger's line. What's your response?
I'd have to really think about that. I can't come up with an instant response, Philip, because I haven't had the chance to examine what's happening in terms of the drone campaign in the eastern areas of Afghanistan and the tribal areas of Pakistan. I would endorse exactly what Carl has said about the nature of the bombing in Cambodia and
then
in
it
Vietnam.
Stiffens resolve, in effect.
But I think that we should be very careful not to take it as the sole explanation for why the Khmer Rouge behaved as they did once they won in 1975. I think it's a matter of dubious historical analysis simply to say that the bombing campaign explains everything about the Khmer Rouge.
Okay, what are the other causes?
I have a long-held view that among the leadership of the Khmer Rouge, there was a deep disgust with what they saw about the corrupt nature of government in Phnom Penh. And I don't think one can overemphasize this point, that they saw in the way in which the government operated, first under Sihanouk and then under the Lon Nol regime, that this was disgusting and corrupt. And everything we know, and there is not nearly as much as we would like to know, about Pol Pot, Salot Sar as he was, and his confreres in France in the 1950s, gives us a picture of people who were very much affected by European communism, and particularly by the French Marxist, Stalinist party in France, and a deep sense that something quite total had to be done in order to bring salvation to Cambodia.
Carl, can you explain China's support of Pol Pot even after the Vietnamese withdrew in 79?
Yes, after communists seized power in Phnom Penh in April 17th and Vietnam April 30th, some border problems, island problems emerged. And there's some evidence that China tried to mediate and get both sides to pull back. But increasingly, it was clear that there was going to be a standoff, and China ceased being neutral and began providing assistance and support to the Khmer Rouge, and particularly military support. And from that point on, I mean, you had raids by the Khmer Rouge across the border, attacking villages and killing hundreds of people, if not more, in that. And Vietnam intervened in the final quarter of 1977 to try to trash the base areas, and then withdrew, and then finally made the decision to go all the way in. And once it did it, that was a challenge to China as an ally of the Khmer Rouge, and then China launched a punitive attack on Vietnam's border in 79.
It might be useful, Milton, to remind the listener how people responded to the Khmer Rouge when it hit town, because there was a lot of initial support and approval.
Well, the initial enthusiasm that the war was over lasted about 24 hours. There were people who were sure that this was going to be an opportunity for a reconciliation between the two sides. After all, there were many people in Phnom Penh when the Khmer Rouge marched in on April the 17th of 1975 who knew people on the other side and therefore expected that all was going to be okay. That enthusiasm and euphoria, as I say, lasted barely 24 hours.
But in the realpolitik, there were quite a few. The regime was recognised internationally by many governments.
That is true, and it is a disgraceful commentary on the failure of people to accept what was happening.
Okay, Carl, when did the world know what was happening? When did, you know, I can remember when information started to trickle through, but remind us of how and when it got out.
Well, I would say just prior to the Vietnamese invasion, American consular officials operating in southern Vietnam were interviewing refugees fleeing from Cambodia and began to piece together this, and a major paper was put out by one of the American Political Science Association back in there. Reader's Digest and others began surfacing it, but until the Vietnamese invasion, it wasn't a major issue that got our attention. It wasn't one that was covered with the television and as current conflicts are. So after the Vietnamese, prior to the invasion, were sending greetings to the Cambodian Communist Party, and after, they went on a propaganda spree of just trying to play up the genocidal nature of the regime. But I suspect it's the debate in the UN, the requirement, the debate that forced countries to take sides, and the U.S. aligning with the non-communist resistance, China backing the Khmer Rouge against the Soviet-backed Vietnam, then led to all these charges. Vietnam ran its own war crimes tribunal out of Phnom Penh to condemn the leaders back in 79. So afterwards, we learn more, and then the Vietnamese set up exhibits. I visited in 81, and I think Milton just preceded me. At that particular point, you could be taken to the Tool Slang prison. You could be taken to the mass graves right outside Phnom Penh. So there was a real attempt to play up what had occurred.
Milton, you're busting to get back in on this.
Yes, I don't often disagree. I seldom disagree, I think, with Carl, but I have to say I don't think he's right. On the 15th of July, 1975, Henry Kam wrote a 60-column-inch story in the New York Times. It was a front-page story. It was based on a whole range of interviews that Henry Kam had carried out, and it was utterly correct in what it had to say. There was a disinclination by people to accept what the refugees coming out of Cambodia were saying, because they were refugees. In early 1976, Father François Panchaud published material in Le Monde, and he was bitterly condemned by people on the progressive side of politics in Libération in Paris, because no one wanted to know. And I must say, I'm very glad to say, in a self-promoting fashion, in 1976, I wrote about what was happening, and I condemned the silence of people, including, I have to say, my old mentor at Cornell University, George Kane, who simply refused to accept that something terrible was happening.
I want to go back to Sebastian. Sebastian, if you visit Moscow, there are still people. In fact, there's probably, I think, a growing undercurrent of people who still idealize and idolize Stalin. And there's certainly a neo-Maoist phenomena observable in China. In the Cambodia you know, are there people who still look back to Pol Pot with admiration?
Well, I mean, you have those people that serve in some capacity as Khmer Rouge soldiers. And they, many of them, still say that their fight was just their fight to protect Cambodia's territorial integrity, as they claim it, from Vietnamese or Thai incursions. They still think quite, you know, they still are loyal to that aim, a lot of them. Ordinary people, you know, the funny thing about Cambodia is that even people that were victimized by the Khmer Rouge, when you ask them, would you, you know, rather have the Vietnamese occupying Cambodia or you know, support a regime that would drive them out? And people, you know, tend to evince positions that are, you know, that are not too far from what the Khmer Rouge sort of advocated, I suppose. It's pretty close to the surface in Cambodia today, and it's for instance, to talk about the opposition leader Sam Rainsy again, he was part of a political coalition known as Phnom Penh Pek, which was founded by Prince Sihanouk in 1981 in Paris to oppose the Vietnamese occupation. And Phnom Penh Pek, throughout the 1980s, and I think until the Paris peace agreements were signed in 1991, were in open alliance with the Khmer Rouge, or the remnants of the Khmer Rouge. And so, you know, there's this sort of sense that, you know, Cambodian nationalism is bad, but, you know, Vietnamese occupation is a lot worse.
Yeah, okay. What's your view about the relative merits of Cambodia running its own race, however unsuccessfully, and Vietnamese dominance, Carl?
Could you repeat part of that question about the Cambodians? I didn't quite catch that. Versus Vietnamese dominance.
Yeah.
Cambodia running their own
state. In other
words,
is a bad Cambodian government, in a sense, preferable to a fairly benign Vietnamese overlord?
Well, my impression was the Vietnamese treated Cambodia lightly in some respects as advisors. They kept the heartland of Cambodia, the rice-growing area and the population, generally free from the Khmer Rouge, pushed the conflict out. They created a series of advisors. They used the Leninist form to try to create a political organization. And if we look at other interventions across the world, the Vietnamese have been successful in one sense. Hun Sen is still there, so he's managed to do it on his own. And I think the ethos was when the Vietnamese were there, you couldn't organize the countryside and the peasantry in any firm way like collectives that had been done in Vietnam, because people were just so anti-Pol Pot and anti the oppression that they suffered that it was just best to leave it alone. And Vietnam's main motivation was, and I believe this, to eventually get out of Cambodia, which they did. I met their foreign minister in 81, and he just said the longer they're there, the more the forces of Cambodian nationalism would work against them. So the Vietnamese were there. They set up a government that survived and has altered and morphed in its own way and withdrew. And I don't think we could look at a heavy hand by the Vietnamese against the Cambodian population.
Milton, following the Vietnamese invasion in 79, ousted the Khmer Rouge, Vietnam was seen as somehow having created the Cambodian problem rather than ending it.
Well, that's one way of looking at it, it was a very much a political way of looking at it. It's a complex situation where you have to say that the Vietnamese liberated the Cambodians from the Khmer Rouge and at the same time established a regime where they were effectively the suzerains of an internal vassal state. Now, subject to a number of things that have been floating around here, there was tremendous problems for the Vietnamese in having, as Carl put it, a relatively light-handed control over the government when there simply wasn't the structure, the personnel to run the country. They had the National Liberation or the National Salvation Front, to which Hun Sen and other former Khmer Rouge officials belonged, but they had no real experience in administering a country. And the Vietnamese proconsul, when interviewing journalists in the early 1980s, said, quite frankly, we just don't have the people here to run the country. But it did, in the years that follow, the regime did manage to establish itself, and I think that to go back to the question you put to Carl, ultimately, from a Cambodian point of view, even a Cambodian regime that lacks in many ways the ideal characteristics of a regime is better than having a Vietnamese regime.
We're running out of time. I want to put this to you, Sebastian. The Khmer Rouge remained resilient right up to the 1990s. Was this because of their fighting prowess or the incompetence of Cambodia's armed forces?
Well, I think the first thing you have to look at is the political context of the time. This is a period in which you had intense Cold War polarization throughout the 1980s, which allows the Khmer Rouge to survive being overthrown in 1979. And it begins to receive direct support from China, as it had, of course, during its time in power. And it also receives indirect support from the West, in the sense that the coalition of which the Khmer Rouge was a part, which opposed the Vietnamese occupation of Cambodia, a coalition of resistance groups, received direct funding and diplomatic support from ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, and much of the West, including the United States and Australia, at least for a time. And so this, the calculus of Cold War geopolitics allows the Khmer Rouge to be essentially reborn and to maintain its fighting power It gives it indirect access to a lot of emergency aid, which was brought into the Thai border to alleviate the refugee crisis at the time. And the Khmer Rouge survived through to the Paris Peace Agreement. They signed the agreements as an equal member, one of the four factions, competing Cambodian factions that signed the accords. And then after the Paris Peace Agreements and the UN mission of 1992 and 1993 winds up, the Khmer Rouge are then marginalized to a great extent, even though Cambodian leaders in the CPP and in Phun Sinpek are competing to sort of for Khmer Rouge defectors to come over to their side. And the regime, or what, you know, the remnant of the regime limps on until about late 1998. The final leaders defect, I think it was Christmas Day, 1998. And then in early 1999, the final sort of strongholds of the Khmer Rouge are overrun by the Cambodian military. But it's a pretty sordid tale, really.
And it's still a pretty sordid tale, but I'm afraid we're running out of time. One final and very brief question to you. To you, Milton, because I know how deeply you love the place and how much of your life has been committed to it. Do you have any optimism that things are going to get much better?
I'd put it another way, Philip. I don't have a deep pessimism because I think that we have a remarkably resilient people despite all of the psychological traumas that have been discussed this evening. I do have long-term but very cautious optimism.
And on that semi-happy note, we will end our discussion. And I thank you very much, Milton Osman, former diplomat, historian, a visiting fellow at the Lowy Institute for International Policy. And I commend to you his wonderful book on the Mekong, which comes up a lot in the programs we've taped. Thank you also, Carl Thayer, Emeritus Professor, University of New South Wales School of Humanities and Social Sciences at the Australian Defence Force Academy. And thank you, Sebastian Sprengau, I'm glad we finally got you, the author of Hun Sen's Cambodia, and he was on the line from Sri Lanka. And as promised, we're now going to whiz off to Cuba and the Castros. As we've been telling you, dear listeners, it's been a lively time in New York with the Pope passing through and the United Nations General Assembly holding its 70th session. It's been a very busy week for Fidel's little brother, Raul. He hosted the Pope last week. He addressed the UN meeting for the first time on Monday when he took the opportunity to demand that the US lift the embargo and return the US naval base at Guantanamo to Cuban control. Now, Castro followed his speech with a meeting with Obama yesterday to progress the so-called normalized relations between the US and Cuba, promised in an historic announcement by not one but two presidents in December last year. Slow thaw, though, while the US opened its embassy in Havana to much fanfare in July, the Cuban president says that normalization cannot proceed unless the trade and travel embargo is lifted. And whilst Obama might agree, he needs the support of Congress to do so, and that's problematic. Professor Barry Carr is a senior fellow at the Institute of Latin American Studies at La Trobe, and recently presented a seminar on transitions for Cuba at the Institute of Latin American Studies at La Trobe, which, for those of you who don't know, resides in Melbourne. He's a former regular on our Little Wireless program, and he joins us from the ABC studios in Melbourne. Welcome back. And Raul reminded the world this week that despite the so-called normalisation, the embargo or blockade is still in place. How significant is it, Barry?
Well, you're right. The Cubans do insist on using that word blockade. It's pretty important still. It effectively makes trade almost impossible between the United States and Cuba, although there are some exceptions. But more seriously for Cuba, it places lots of obstacles in the way of other countries trading with Cuba, and it makes it also very difficult for, say, foreign banks who in one way or another have transactions with Cuba. It makes it almost impossible for them, or very difficult for them, and very expensive.
I think I sort of half remember that Canada was ignoring the embargo.
Well, the embargo is ignored by everybody except for the United States. I mean, everybody trades with Cuba. But if you are a foreign bank with some interest in the United States, you could easily be fined very large sums of money. I mean, a major French bank, the Banque Nationale de Paris, BNP Paribas, was fined, I think, $6 or $8 billion last year for what the United States regarded was violation of the U.S. embargo. So the embargo is important. It doesn't stop trade between other countries in Cuba, but it makes it a lot more expensive, and it's cost Cuba, according to the latest estimates, about $120 billion. That's what the Cuban foreign minister has said, $120 billion worth of damage since the embargo was imposed in the early 1960s.
The reason I gave Canada a sort of koala stamp there was because they have played a useful role. The Pope's visit was important. The Vatican advisors secretly helped broker the negotiations between the US and Cuba. But so did Canada.
Yes, Canada's been important because it's a country in the Americas, and it has a border with the United States, and it has maintained diplomatic relations with Cuba. There's been fairly close relations, and most importantly, if you go to Cuba and have a beach holiday, which last year about 3 million people did, you'll find lots and lots and lots of Canadians, both English-speaking and French-speaking. They're the single largest group of foreign tourists there. And so it's also a fairly major investor in areas of mining and in the tourism economy.
Who called in the Vatican to help build bridges of understanding?
Well, that's a very interesting question. We don't yet have a full story, the backstory of exactly how this normalization that was announced last December, how it happens. Like, we don't know whether the initiative came from the Cuban side, from the US side, from the Vatican. What we do know is that the Catholic Church in Cuba has been jockeying for a position of power for quite some time. It sees itself as being a major actor in the process of both national reconciliation within Cuba, but also in reconciliation between Cuba and the United States. So it's quite likely that the Vatican would be a major player for that reason.
Let me ask you this. What's the relationships within Cuba between the Church and the Castros?
Well, currently things are pretty decent in the sense that the worst phases of hostility towards and discrimination towards the Catholic Church are long past. They really happened in the 60s and the early 1970s. So there are churches, you can go to mass, there are churches being built, there are priests being trained.
This is good news because it means I can travel there in religious confidence.
You can, although I'm not sure whether you'd want to travel there wearing religious garb. You rarely see people, priests, and actually in religious garb. But what the church can't do, and it's very antsy and angry about this, is it's not allowed to run schools, for example. But it runs all kinds of social welfare programs. It publishes some of the most interesting independent magazines in Cuba. And it's fighting a battle all the time to try and remind Cubans that they used to be Catholic and that all those strange Afro-Cuban religions and practices that are also very strong in Cuba are something that you ought to put on to one side.
Well, look at the huge bounce back of the Orthodox in what was the Soviet Union. Religion doesn't go away under pressure, does it? If anything, it intensifies.
Yeah, you're right. But in the Cuban case, I think there are many ways, there are many forms of religiosity, and it would be wrong to assume that just because we know that Catholicism was the in the supermarket of religions, if one is allowed to say that, is the top product on sale for most countries. It's not been the same case in Cuba for a number of historical reasons. The Catholic Church was relatively weak in Cuba before the revolution, partly because the church made a couple of really major mistakes. Like, for example, during Cuba's independence war, it took the side of Spain, the colonial power. Well, that's definitely a no-no. Whereas, so there've been all that those kinds of problems. Plus, it's had, because Cuba's so close to the United States, the Catholic Church in Cuba has had a long history of competition from American Protestant denominations. And of course, there's the religious side to the millions of Cubans who are of African origin, and there's Santeria and all kinds of other religious practices too.
Now, okay, Obama used executive authority to relax parts of the embargo, but when he addressed the UN on Monday, he had to highlight his support for going further. But he went so far to say that he believes Congress will take this step. Well, it's a pretty big step, given the dominance of the Republicans.
Yeah, it's wishful thinking in some ways, unless he has some kind of access to congressional news that we don't have.
Is it the power of papal prayer, perhaps?
It might indeed possibly be that. Or it may be that he is, of course, approaching the end of his second presidential term and he really can't lose. You can do bold things when you're only going to be a president for another 15 months or so. But certainly the Republicans are going to control Congress, and all the suggestions are amongst the political experts on the US that whatever happens in the presidential elections, if there's a Democrat winning, which might perhaps be the best, the most likely of the options, the Republicans will still have a dominant position in Congress. And they made it absolutely clear that they're not going to budge on this issue. And it's not just that they're not prepared to budge, but some years ago, Congress passed new laws which effectively removed from a US president who has enormous reserve powers, removed the right to tinker with the embargo. And there, of course, there are several Republican sort of front runners, although one of them I notice has just abandoned the field. But Mr. Cruz and Mr. Rubio, of course, of Cuban origin. So yeah. You don't want to muck around with them.
Coming back to your view about Obama, one day a rooster, the next day a feather duster. He doesn't want to be lame duck, and so now he's showing a remarkable spurt of energy. So when they met on Tuesday in Washington, Obama's accompanied by John Kerry, Secretary of State, National Security Advisor Susan Rice, U.S. Ambassador to the UN Samantha Power. He's sort of lining his guns up, isn't he?
Yes, there's no question about that. I think that he's trying to signal not only to Cuba, but he's trying to signal to the US public. And I think also he's signaling to Latin America. And in fact, Obama in December of last year did make it clear when he was announcing the normalization. He said that not only had US policy failed towards Cuba, that it was also a permanent embarrassment in the United States' relations with Latin America. So Mr. Kerry earlier also said that the Monroe Doctrine was no longer in existence, which didn't really cause much of a ripple in the rest of the world, but which I suppose symbolizes an attempt to shift the nature of the conversation about this. So I don't doubt for one minute that Obama would like to see a full normalization, but he's got his hands tied here.
Well, the big one, I suppose, in the wish list of RAL is the demand of the return of Guantanamo Bay. Now, in a way, of course, Obama would love to close it down. It was one of his major campaign points when he was a would-be president. But there's no way any American government, and I can see in the near future, would do that.
Well, we have to distinguish between two different, very different things. I think Obama did say before the elections that he wanted to close down the U.S. prison at the Guantanamo Naval Base and the torture center, because he acknowledged that the United States had been torturing some of the prisoners there. But I don't think Obama actually said that he wanted to close down the naval base.
No.
There is a big distinction, especially if you happen to be Cuban. So I think it's not impossible that the prison will be closed down, because it's slowly being emptied of its remaining prisoners. But for the base itself, which has been under U.S. control really since 1904, that it would be a huge step, although it would be a symbolic step of enormous importance for not only Cuba, but I think for the rest of Latin America. But I somehow can't see any U.S. president doing that, because it stands as a kind of symbol of 200 years of history of the U.S. as the great hegemon in Latin America.
It's interesting that while this is being discussed, the Philippines government is umming and ahhing about welcoming them back.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, Raul has called on the U.S. to repay billions of dollars in damages. What's he talking about?
Well, when you have normalization diplomatically, normally part of that would involve a consideration of some kind of settlement of outstanding claims between countries. And as a part of the Cuban Revolution, its early years, Cuba nationalized a lot of assets, particularly of big U.S. corporations in the mining sector, in the sugar sector, in services, and so on. And Cuba has in recent years been trying to settle those claims, most recently with Spain. And I noticed that Mr. Putin, who hasn't received as warm a handshake, I think, from Mr. Obama as Mr. Castro has in the last 24 hours, did actually cancel recently the debts of the old Soviet Union. The problem is that the U.S. and many Cuban Americans want to see some kind of a compensation for the nationalization of U.S. properties. But the Cubans say, well, it takes two to tango, and if we add up all the damage caused by the U.S. blockade plus the destruction of Cuban agriculture through terrorist actions, et cetera, et cetera. If you add all that up together, you get to a figure of around about $125 billion. So while we may owe U.S.-based people about $30 billion, you guys owe us $125. So why don't we do a nice little calculation, and we'll end up by you only have to pay us about $80 billion. So that's more or less where the deal is at the moment.
It's important to realize how much governments fear precedent. We've just been in Vietnam, and the Vietnamese are understandably a bit upset about the so-called American War and the massive amount of damage that did. Even the spraying of Agent Orange is an ongoing catastrophe. They've been trying to get the Americans even to give them a few hundred million just to clean up the Agent Orange problem, let alone, the huge repair bill that they could claim. And the Americans are playing hardball. And that doesn't seem to matter whether it's a Democratic presidency or a Republican presidency. Governments hate the thought of having to pay for past mistakes.
Yep. Absolutely, and the more past they are, the more difficult and expensive they become. So we just think of all the demands being made by countries where there was slavery, for example, for compensation for the crime of slavery. That was Jamaica in recent years, and some Caribbean countries have begun to make those kinds of claims. So I don't think anything is going to be done there, although some people in U.S. Congress have suggested that one way of compensating U.S.-based entrepreneurs might be to use some of the money, Cuban assets that have been seized and frozen by the U.S., or indeed some of these enormous fines that the U.S. has imposed on foreign banks, that maybe some of that money can be used to compensate people who live in the United States, or companies or organizations.
Well, how are is the Cuban diaspora viewing all of this? What's the view from, places like Florida?
Well, there's been a huge change there, Philippe, and that's, I think, one of the many elements in the cocktail which explains why we have this normalization. Traditionally, Cuban Americans, who mostly are based in Florida, but there's also a very significant number who live in New Jersey, about whom we hear less, were very opposed to any kind of tinkering with the freezing of relations and the embargo. But there's been a generational shift, and all the polls suggest that the Cuban-American population in Florida is now pretty much accepting of the need for normalization. I think the latest poll last week conducted by the Miami Herald was about 66% of Cuban-Americans in the Miami area were in favor. And if you were to break that poll down and just look at younger Cubans, however that's defined, Cuban-Americans, however that's defined, the figure goes up to 90%. So that's no longer an excuse. In other words, one can't say anymore in politics, hey, there's a big price that we, the Democrats or the Republicans for that matter, would have to pay in a state like Florida, which has strategically always been a very important state in the U.S. elections. So that's changed, I think, enormously. And lots of Cuban Americans now are actually not only returning to Cuba, they've been allowed to do that for quite some time, but they're also taking back money to invest in small-scale businesses in little hotels, in bars, in restaurants, either legally or illegally. So it's always a very strange kind of a deal in which out of the one side of the mouth, people will say, we can't stand those dreadful Castros. But there are other, from the other side of the mouth, there's still the kind of interest in making a buck or two, because after all, Cuba is kind of virgin territory in many ways.
Well, of course, apart from a boom business in cigars and in concert tours by octogenarian musicians, the great industry in Cuba at the time when Castro took over was gaming, was gambling. And I wonder whether there's also some people in Las Vegas, perhaps our own James Packer, who might be hoping that you will have a new thrust of casino building.
Well, that's an interesting point. He hasn't been doing too well in Macau, I gather, from the business news recently. I haven't heard any noises coming from the old gambling interests, I suppose in part because so many of them were either in jail or dead or otherwise...
I'm talking
about the US ones. Of course, yes, we do have to make that point. I don't think we're going to see gambling. What we will see, I think, is cruise ships, and I suppose you're on cruises, you know, cruise ships, you can have gambling as long as you're 20 or 30 kilometres away from the coast. But
being a bit whimsical, but it's true. You know, the place was a huge casino. Its dearth or death was a great boom to Las Vegas, so you must be thinking about it.
Yes, I hope that we would eventually one day have access to the files. I mean, there's the historian in me speaking, because we need a really good documented history of gambling in Cuba. And as somebody who's very interested in the mafia, and Maya Lansky, of course, was the most important of the mafia figures in pre-revolutionary Cuba. There's quite a few biographies of him, but we don't know enough about Maya Lansky, the Jewish mafia, I think, which is the East Coast mafia. We need to know a great deal more about Lansky and that group, and the archives simply haven't been opened up for us.
And Raul Castro didn't mention any of this in his speech, but look, I was being whimsical. Barry, thank you enormously. Professor Barry Carr, who, as I said, was a regular on the program, and it's great to have him back. Thanks, Barry. Well, that's a wrap for the Little Wireless program, and tomorrow we're going back to Cambodia, and I'm going to introduce you to two incredibly courageous, creative people who are working modest miracles with young people in Cambodia, both in saving them from corrupt orphanages and in teaching them about their own country's history. Ellie Nell on RN, The News Now. See you later.